how much does the fact that there is such a tier of four at the top of the position affect how you should view the position in mixed leagues, Mike?
I know Jeff Quinton talked about this a little bit today, and today is Monday as I'm talking to you, so it will be yesterday when you hear this. Time is funny that way.
Here's to us, November, and the waning sun, and all the proofs I'd like to prove. We go down tonight.
Good evening, and welcome to episode 76 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Gianella and George Bissell. How are you guys doing? It's February. Did everyone caucus in Iowa tonight?
I was going to say tonight is a night for politics, but we are not part of the party, so no.
Sadly, I did not caucus like Dukakis.
Oh man,
no.
We're off to a rousing start.
I'm really sad about this Corey Dickerson trade. Still, I don't think I've recovered yet.
It doesn't sound like you've recovered.
No, and
do
then
you have
Greg,
him in like do you have him in all of your leagues?
I have him in every league, and also Greg Bird kind of died today, so. That's another sad story. It's been a rough week.
That is rough.
Yeah, it's been a rough week for George.
It's all right. We'll get through it.
This is true. Just like we'll get through this podcast. You can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell. It's two S's and two L's. You can rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher or other things. You can email us at flagsflyforever@baseballprospectus.com. We are going to eschew questions this week and go straight into third baseman. We will talk a lot about the hot corner after we come right back. And welcome back. So as we have done every week since this whole thing started, we are going to take a quick look back at 2015, just to see what we learned and what we can bring into 2016 with us. So let's start with the American League. Mike, what's your biggest takeaway from 2015 when you put together these valuations?
Well, you know, first of all, at the top of the position in Josh Donaldson and Manny Machado, we haven't seen, you know, since I think 2010. You have to go back to when A-Rod was still third base eligible. You had Evan Longoria had his one big year that people have been paying for forever. And you had Adrian Beltre in his prime. You just haven't seen value at the top like this. And, you know, with Josh Donaldson, you know, who's speaking of A-Rod, you know, Donaldson is the only third baseman in the history of baseball to hit 40 or more home runs, score 120 more runs, and drive in 120 more runs in a season. A-Rod did it twice. I mean, that's just amazing. But beyond that, there's just a kind of a broad base of guys in the American League at third base. It's definitely the stronger position. We do lose Chris Davis this year to first base. He was eligible at third for a year. We do lose Xander Bogaerts, who goes back to being shortstop only. We lose Carlos Santana. And we lose A-Rod, who was technically third base eligible. But even with all that, it's a strong position. You've got Todd Frazier coming over from the other league. It's just pretty deep. And then even in the middle, you've got guys like Trevor Plouffe, like Danny Valencia, even players like Chase Headley and Nick Castellanos. It's a solid position all the way down. You know, if you look at the spreadsheet that we have out there for baseball prospective subscribers that has retrospective valuations, a lot of $10 plus earners at the position in the American League.
Yeah, it's really chunky. And you kind of touched a little bit on what my biggest takeaway here is. And, you know, it goes back to Evan Longoria. You mentioned it before. there's nothing wrong with Evan Longoria, but I think we're finally getting to the point where his name value is depressed enough that he's not an incredible overdraft anymore. And he's, you know, do you know off the top of your head what his earnings have been the last like 3 or 4 years?
I can go back further because for the State of the Position article, I'm sorry, for the American League article I'm doing on Friday, I put this together. He has earned from 2011 to 2015, he's earned $97 combined. And in that time, do you guys want to guess over those 5 years, not on average, but in total, what he's cost?
I think he's cost $145.
George?
I was going to say 145. I'll go 150.
153. Yeah. I mean, he is, you know, it's amazing. He's been paid an average of over $30 a season, and he's earned a little bit under 20 a season. Now, last year, as Brett points out, you know, he's finally come closer to, you know, he cost 25 here in 19 with decimals. He lost $5. I do think the market's finally recognizing that, yeah, there's nothing wrong with Evan Longoria. He's a solid player, but offensively, at least, and in fantasy, he's just not going to live up to that hype that he once had about, you know, potentially being, you know, kind of a poor man's A-Rod.
No, and you get him and having him and Danny Valencia and Trevor Plouffe all kind of in the same general area is exactly the point. You know, Plouffe earned $17 last year, Longoria earned $19, and Plouffe is Plouffe is nobody in drafts compared to Longoria, and that's, you know, that should change. And I think it is changing.
Yeah, I think Longoria will still go for more, but you know, I do think that it'll, like you're saying, it'll be a little closer. Longoria will probably go closer to 20 this year. Plouffe will probably go closer to 15, and that's the thing. I think the market will recognize the gap, you know, with Longoria and finally stop paying him. You know, guy, I'm interested to see what happens this year. You know, is Mike Moustakas, who earned 21, average salary of 9. You know, I know some of it was Babbitt fueled, but on the other hand, he did look like a better hitter last year.
Yeah. So let's toggle over to the National League where things were slightly more bleak, and we are losing a couple people over here as well. How does the up and coming duo at the top of the position compared to the AL's top two with Arenado and Bryant?
Well, they're not quite as strong. Arenado earned 34. Bryant earned 28 in only formats compared to 37 for Donaldson and 35 for Machado. Although something to keep in mind about that is if you flip Bryant to the American League or applied him to a mixed league, steals were worth less or a little bit less in the National League because they were more plentiful. So that kind of plays a factor a little bit. You know, you do lose Frazier, as you alluded to, Brett. You know, he's further down the pile, but Aramis Ramirez retired, so he's gone. Ryan Zimmerman is no longer third base eligible. Pedro Alvarez, even if he does wind up somewhere in the National League, there's some interesting Phillies rumors with him that I heard today. Here in Philadelphia, he's first base eligible. So, yeah, there's a lot that's in flux here. You know, if you want to look at a positive, you know, you're going to get a full season out of Michael Franco. I don't think you can simply extrapolate, you know, his $13 in earnings to say he's going to earn 26. But, you know, if he's on the north side of 20 by a little bit, that wouldn't really surprise me. And you've got some solid guys. You know, the way I look at this, you've got some solid guys like Matt Duffy and Justin Turner. Duffy earned 24. I don't see him doing that again, but I can see him in the high teens. Justin Turner earned 18. I can see him doing that again. But they're guys that kind of don't have the big power, the big speed. They're just sort of the all-around solid in five categories, but not the kind of studs or guys that are going to go well into the 20s that you are going to have in the American League.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. George, any thoughts on the National League list before we move on?
No, I think we hit on everything. Let's dive into the tiers because I know we have a lot to talk about.
We do. So the interesting discussion as we look at the top of the list is how much does the fact that there is such a tier of four at the top of the position affect how you should view the position in mixed leagues, Mike?
Well, you know, it's probably it depends. Obviously, we talk about this every week. It depends on the depth of the leagues, but I do think that in a shallow 12-team mixed league, while it'd be nice to kind of get one of these guys, I don't think it's necessary. I do think in a 15-team mixed league, the calculus changes a little bit because, you know, and I know Jeff Quinton talked about this a little bit today, and today is Monday as I'm talking to you, so it will be yesterday when you hear this. Time is funny that way, and I'm sure that's going to open up the podcast or be the title. But
time is funny that way.
Time is funny that way, George, yes.
It certainly is.
It certainly is. But Jeff talked about this. He talked about the fact that there are guys like Frazier and Carpenter and Kyle Seager who, you know, they're still pretty good. But I think there's enough of a fall off there that you do want to get or try to get one of the top guys if they're appropriately priced. And I think even more so in a 15-team league, there is that risk of getting somebody like a Justin Turner or a Matt Duffy as your starter at the bottom, which is enough of a fall off to me that if I don't get one of the top four, I do want to get one of the top seven or eight, just because I see some risk there and some suckage. And, you know, quite honestly, in a 15-team league, the replacement level at third, as opposed to, say, compared first, there's really a drop off. Like, I don't want to wind up with Giovanni Urshela as my replacement if my third baseman goes down.
Yeah. It's it's a really interesting mix and divide of players along the way. So let's jump right into the tier. So let's talk about the top four in a little bit more detail. I think there's been plenty of talk of these guys anyway, so I don't think we'll dwell on it too much. George, we'll start with an interesting question. If you had to pick one of these four guys to just have a really disappointing season compared to their ADP, which one do you think it is? Donaldson, Machado, Arenado, or Bryant?
I think it's Chris Bryant because I think there is some batting average risk there. When you look at him, he struck out in 31% of his plate appearances last year, so that equates to a 66% contact rate. He hit .275, but that's thanks to a .378 BABIP. Now, some power hitters, like think Miguel Cabrera, Giancarlo Stanton, they can run extremely high BABIPs because when they do make contact, they're crushing the ball, and it's resulting in hits. But I still think that mark's really high, and I think he's due for a little bit of a step back in average. I mean, if you just look historically, in the last 5 years, this is a stat I uncovered when I was doing my early ADP analysis piece, but only four hitters have posted a lower single-season contact rate than Bryant in the last 5 years. And there are some pretty ugly names on this list: Josh Hamilton, Mark Reynolds, Chris Carter, and Pedro Alvarez. So I do think there is some batting average risk. Obviously, you know, the foundation is there for a legitimate fantasy superstar here with Chris Bryant. I mean, the numbers last year were insane. But right now he's going in the top 10, and I don't feel as confident in him building off of last year as I do Josh Donaldson, Manny Machado, and Nolan Arenado maintaining the gains they made last season. So I think the riskiest of all of them is probably Chris Bryant because I think he's going to struggle with the strikeouts. That's going to continue to be an issue for him going forward.
Mike, what about do you agree?
I do agree, although, you know, there's something I just want to add to all this is yes, Bryant is everything George said is on point. Bryant's the guy who has the most risk. He kind of ties a little bit into Giancarlo Stanton in that he's a very gifted hitter. Stanton had a very similar minor league profile and a very similar profile his rookie year. And if anybody can beat that profile, it's somebody with the, you know, the ability of Bryant or Stanton. I do want to say, and just kind of caution about this, as good as he is and as solid as a pick he is, you know, I pointed this out before, Josh Donaldson did something, you know, for the third time in history with those counting stats. This isn't to take away from what he can do, but I feel like if Donaldson only hits 35 home runs, you know, only drives in 100, you know, only scores 100, those numbers are all perfectly fine. But based on where he's being drafted, particularly he doesn't really run and he's not a spectacular batting average option, you do lose a little bit with him. So I don't think he's a big performance risk. I just think the odds of him putting up all of those numbers again and everything kind of clicking for him the way it did last year, it's just going to be difficult to do just because it would be difficult for anybody to do. But yeah, it's Brian. Brian's a guy who I think is the riskiest. And, you know, if he finishes with, say, fourth or fifth round value, which is still really good, I don't think anyone should be particularly surprised.
At the same time, like, the upside with Bryant is insane. He had a 317 true average last year with a 31% strikeout rate. So, he could be a top five overall hitter. It wouldn't shock me, but at the same time, I think he really could take a step back this year, and it wouldn't shock me either.
Mm-hmm. I think everyone to an extent is comfortable with Donaldson and Machado, but what do we think about Nolan Arenado? He is, you know, he's a player who was, even with Coors, was never supposed to hit for this kind of power, has never hit for this kind of power anywhere in his entire career. His previous career high was 18 before he hit 42 this past season. He's not the power hitter that Chris Bryant is, but he is the contact hitter that Chris Bryant is not. What do you guys think is a fair over under for Arenado's power in 2016? If I set the over under at 26, Mike, would you take the over or the under?
I'll still take the over. I agree with the premise. I think that power is kind of unprecedented. But the thing about those 18 home runs is it wasn't a full season. He did play a full season last year. He does have the Coors bump. He's enough of a power hitter that I think, you know, he's not Carlos Gonzalez, who, you know, when last year when he's clicking could hit a home run anywhere. There is a bit of that, you know, away from Coors drag. I'm predicting 30 to 32 for Arenado, so I'm going with the over. I think he'll get it, but I agree with the premise. I think 40 plus home runs from him, if he does it 2 years in a row, you tip your cap and you realize that he's capable of it. But it's to your point, it's not a good bet.
I'll take the over as well. I mean, Mike touched on it, but Coors Field obviously is huge for his value. But he did have 22 home runs on the road last year. I don't think he's going to do that again exactly. But I think 30 is reasonable if you want to set the floor there. I think he could do that again. I wouldn't bet on 42 or anything close to 40 again.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I think I'm a little lower than you guys. I would take the under. I would take the under on 30. For sure. And that's not to say he's not a good hitter. I just don't, I'm not buying into that big of a power jump from last year to this year. That's, you know, that's really never been his profile. And he went through really weird swings in power last year. He hit 12 home runs in June, and then he hit 12 home runs in September. And then in the other 4 months, he hit a combined 17, by math, right? Yeah. By math. No, 18. So it was not consistent power across the season. And I mean, we're obviously nitpicking. I still think Arenado is a first round pick in 15 team leagues, but, you know, if you go in with the expectation that he's going to hit 40 home runs again, I think that's kind of nuts at this point.
Brett, where do you think the batting average ends up? Because he had 287 last year, but you mentioned it. I mean, he's a guy who doesn't strike out very often. He had 110 strikeouts and almost 700 plate appearances. So,
well, that's what I think the interesting part is. I think he's more likely to hit 300 than he is to hit 30 home runs.
Right. So if he trades a little bit of the power for average, that's going to almost cancel that out a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, and I'd take that, which is part of why I think there's some safety in his value. You know, Coors Field provides a little bit of safety to everybody's value in Colorado, but the contact combined with Coors Field, I think it puts some of that, you know, real trapdoor potential aside.
This makes me think of Corey Dickerson, and now I'm sad.
All right, let's move on before he. before George thinks about Corey Dickerson more.
Why Colorado? Why? Just why?
We can discuss this during outfield week and pass out the tissues then.
Okay. That's true. So the four-star tier is kind of an interesting group. It's a number of names that I think we've expected to see in this range. And then there's Michael Franco. Mike, you're our resident Philadelphia expert. How good could Franco be this year?
Well, you know, the funny thing about Franco is, you know, he's a guy who I think surprised people a little bit last year with the power. But he, you know, and you know this more than I do because, you know, you guys are the dynasty minor league guys. He has struggled at almost every level initially. So I think when he struggled in the majors in his brief time up in 2014, people thought, oh, he's not as good as, you know, people think. But he has a legitimate bat. He's not a superstar. I don't think he's ever going to get into the five-star tier, you know, with some of these guys we've been talking about. But I can see him hitting, you know, 25 to 30 home runs this year. The power is legitimate. CBP is overstated as a hitter's park, but it is a power park, which should help him out. The lineup hurts him a little bit as far as some of those counting stats go. But, you know, the thing about the Phillies, which I find kind of funny, is that I think they're the team that isn't going to be, I don't want to say they're going to be good, but they're not going to be as awful as some people think. I could see them winning 70 to 75 games, and I wouldn't blink at that kind of projection, particularly if the timetable on some of these young guys accelerates a little bit, like someone like Crawford, and there's some guys around Franco. I think Franco's pretty solid. He belongs at the bottom of this tier, and if we wanted to rank him at the top of the three-star, I wouldn't have objected too much. It just depends on how you feel about him. But, I think he's legitimate. And for fantasy outside of the steals, he should contribute a little bit everywhere.
I know Pecota has him for 24 home runs. So the only thing I'll say with Franco, and I'll give credit to our good friend. He's a great Phillies follow, Matt Winkleman. He brought it up that some of
Matt's terrific, by the way. Yeah,
yeah, he's really a must follow. He knows his stuff, and he talked a little bit about how Franco's AAA numbers may have been a little bit depressed because Lehigh Valley, the Phillies AAA park, it's a pretty tough place to hit. So Franco's numbers don't look as good in the minors, but when he came up, he hit for a lot of power.
Yeah, it looks almost like, if you've ever been there, I have, it looked almost like a big league park in terms of dimensions. It's pretty close. And just based on where it is in the environment there, like kind of in Allentown or Bethlehem, which is what Lehigh Valley is, it does depress power a little bit because of the air current. So, yeah, it's not really – that's a good point, George. It's not really a place that, you know, you would expect to see a lot of power. And it probably did hurt Frank a little bit, particularly when you compared his numbers to some of his peers.
Yeah, the only thing I want to bring up with Franco is that he had a 47% ground ball rate last year. And anytime you have a mark like that close to 50%, it's just really hard to hit 20 home runs. There just aren't a lot of guys who do that. That's a recurring theme that I seem to run into whenever I do my research on these pieces. And I think he just needs to hit a few more fly balls, and he's really going to take off, so... It's easy to see him finishing in this tier. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Do we think that Matt Carpenter gets the credit that he deserves? The power was unexpected last year, and there are certainly questions as to whether that will continue. How much of a reality, you know, nearly 30 home runs is, but considering his ability to hit for a decent average and the power showing, you know, Carpenter's going 65th overall this year, and we know he doesn't have that second base eligibility anymore because we're talking about him today. But how much of those power gains do you think are real, Mike?
You know, it's really hard to say. I think most of it's real. And I think some of that is he changed his approach last year and he sacrificed average for power. He has the ability to do it. And, you know, I think back to Chase Headley and that one year that he hit for a bunch of power and people thought it was real and it went away. I don't think that's going to happen with Carpenter. But I think the two outcomes for him are either the power or most of it continues and he has a similar season. Or, you know, he hits like, say, 15 to 17 home runs and the average pops back up a little bit. So regardless of the outcome, I think you're going to get the value from Carpenter. It's just going to be a question of how that value manifests.
Yeah, and that really bears out in the numbers because his strikeout rate just flew up. He struck out 111 times in 158 games in 2014 and then struck out 151 times in 154 games in 2015. So the funny thing is he hit 272 both years because you can't predict BABIP. But the change in approach is a very, very real thing. And it'll be interesting to see how that continues into 2016, because he's shown that he can hit for contact. He's shown that he can hit for power. The jury is out as to whether he can really do both at the same time. My guess for that tend to be no, but he's going to certainly have the chance to prove it to everyone this year.
I think the main thing to watch, especially early in the year, is his batted ball profile. Because, I mean, Brett, you talked about the BABIP and trading the contact for power, but he had a 29% line drive rate, which was huge. And then he increased his fly ball rate to 42%. He was at about 35% the previous 3 years. So I think we're going to know pretty early on in April what his batted ball profile looks like and whether or not he's going to hit for more power, for more average. But Mike's right. I think he could go either way. I think either way he's going to be productive, and he's going to return the value on draft day. I'm not worried about that. I just think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out in terms of what type of hitter shows up in 2016.
Yeah, that is a fair point. If I were to tell you that there is a player being drafted in who's in this four-star tier who hit 220, 274, 390 in a hitter's park in the second half of 2015, would that interest you, George?
I know where you're going with this. This is Todd Frazier, isn't it?
It is definitely Todd Frazier.
Do we have any sort of explanation for that second half? Was there an injury that we don't know about that came out? Is there anything like that?
The home run derby syndrome?
Yeah, pretty much.
No, seriously. I mean, you look at his first half, he had, 25 home runs, hit 285, had 8 steals, and then just was terrible in the second half. Just mm-hmm. not good. I don't know what to make of it. There's no explanation.
Yeah, The huge arrow down in 2015 as the season went on, combined with the move to the American League, has me quite down on Frazier for this year. I mean, we've talked about this off air, but I am unlikely to own Todd Frazier in any league this year, and that's absolutely fine with me. I know U.S. Cellular is a good place to hit for power, but man, that's ominous. That second half, and I don't feel good about it.
How concerned are you guys about the steals? Because he had 20 in 2014, but last year he only had 13. I think he was only successful on like 62% of his stolen base attempts. I mean, now he's 30, so we know the value of speed in terms of the valuations. I think that's probably the thing that could hurt his value the most if he really tails off in the stolen base department going forward.
Yeah, he was 13 for 21 last year, which is not the kind of success rate that you want to see. He was 20 for 28 the year before, so he has shown to be not a horrible base stealer at times. But the White Sox are, I don't have a great sense of whether the White Sox are going to, let him run as much as the Reds did, but it's, anecdotally, they feel like a more conservative team on the base paths. I have no hard evidence to back that up though.
Yeah, my take on Frazier is I'm a little bit below his current ADP, and I kind of understand all the concerns. But you know, when all's said and done, I don't really like to extrapolate too much from second half stats, particularly if there isn't a strong reason behind it or something that I can point to, you know, besides the curse of the home run derby. So while I do appreciate all these arguments, and, you know, I probably won't get him either because there's a couple people that I've seen out there that are even higher than his ADP and taking him, you know, kind of at the beginning to the middle of the third round, that I won't take him there. I'm not as concerned as Brett is. I think that Frazier will be okay. You know, the thing that's kind of telling, you know, in mixed leagues, I think Frazier would have, from last year I did this, he would have to lose about 16% of his value to equal what Kyle Seager did. So, you know, for him to fall down behind Seager and behind Carpenter, but behind Seager in particular, he'd really have to slip. Could it happen? Yes. You know, and I think he will slip. You know, I see maybe about 10% slippage from last year. It still puts him ahead of Seager for me and still kind of keeps him at least in the middle of this tier. So I agree with you, Brett, to a point, but I just don't quite see the slippage that you do.
That's a great stat, Mike. I had no idea. That's pretty cool.
Although if Seager bounces up as much as you know, think he will, George, and we should probably talk about this since I did read your target piece.
Do I get like 30 seconds?
That'll be moot. Sure.
All right. Kyle Seager. Basically, he's the model of consistency. He's not a superstar, but he's a damn good player. He's at 20 home runs while hitting .260 in four straight seasons. The only other third baseman to average those types of numbers over that stretch are Josh Donaldson, Adrian Beltre, and Evan Longoria. And obviously, two of those are a bit more mercurial in Beltre and Longoria than Seager. They haven't been as consistent. I just really like what Kyle Seager brings to the table. I think you can just put that production in the bank. And there were some signs in the second half that I know we don't like to extrapolate second half stats too much, but he was a significantly better hitter down the stretch in the second half. I think he had only a .278 BABIP last year. He had been around .290 for his career. So I think if we see a little bit more regression to the mean in that department, he could easily post a higher batting average going forward.
I do dig how the contact rates improve too. That's something I kind of like to see. Yeah. The strikeout rate dropped about 4%, and you know we're looking at very numbers on the margin here. But to your point, George, you know sometimes we do see a guy you know in his 20s you know, or mid to late 20s who you know has been around a while, has been consistent, and some of these marginal improvements can add up to a bigger year.
Yeah, I mean he's only 28, and he hit lefties for really like the first time in his career last year. He hit .297 with 13 homers off southpaws, so there's no risk of him losing playing time against lefties. I think if he's able to sustain those gains, I think you're looking at a guy who could be 25 to 30 home runs and hit near .280, and that's maybe a borderline top five at the position.
He is the kind of player, if he gains a little, I you know, it's a cliche, but if he gains a little, he gains a lot.
Yep.
Yeah. So let's move on to the three stars, because the beginning of the three star tier is famous, and the end of the three star tier is surprising. Let's start at the bottom. Matt Duffy is someone who completely came out of nowhere in 2015, and we've seen this from the Giants quite a bit. What's your baseline expectation, Mike, for Matt Duffy in 2016?
I honestly wish I knew. You know, he's one of those players that I just kind of look at and I shrug. Like I would not have expected him to, you know, not only like survive in the majors but thrive. I would have expected, based on his minor league profile, for him to hit, you know, maybe, you know, seven or eight home runs, steal seven or eight bases, you know, hit .270, just be one of those starters who survived. And you know, instead, what we saw out of him was a lot more than that. Now, the thing that makes me worry a little bit about him is because he kind of came out of nowhere, because there really wasn't much to look at in his minor league profile outside of some speed, is I could see some of that power going away. You know, if that happens, it's kind of the opposite of Seager. You know, if Matt Duffy only hits like .260 to .270, you know, steals, say, you know, 12 bases, but only hits like four or five home runs, that's like deep league material at best. So I don't want to say I'm worried about Duffy, but I think him being at the bottom of this tier is appropriate. And you can be cautious and put him in the next tier down too, because all it takes for a player like Duffy to lose a little bit, because he's not a big power guy, because he's not a big steal guy, is for him to lose, you know, about those 20 points on average. You know, on the BABIP from him, you know, in the majors, it's been consistent so far. But I kind of like to see two full years of BABIP before I kind of make a conclusion on a guy's hitting profile. So, you know, if Duffy came out this year and had a 296 BABIP, say, instead of a 336, you know, and only hit 270, it wouldn't surprise me, but that would really cut into his value.
So let's talk about, I think that's absolutely right. I have no idea what that'll do with Matt Duffy this year. And I'm not even going to try. So
now I feel like a fool.
George, explain, you are I think the slightly high person on Kyle Seager. Explain to me the difference between Kyle Seager and Mike Moustakas.
There isn't a whole lot. If you look at what Moustakas was able to do last year, right around the All-Star break, Moustakas was making a ton of contact and spraying line drives all over the park. And he really tried to shorten his swing and just try and put the ball in play, and it resulted in a really high batting average. I think he was hitting like 300 right around mid-season. Well, that kind of changed in the second half. As his fly ball rate went from 35% to 48% in his final 280 plate appearances, that resulted in 15 home runs after the All-Star break. So I think you're looking at a guy here who he hit 280 last year, and the power's there. I just think if he's able to sustain what he did in the second half power-wise with that batted ball profile, there's no reason to think he couldn't once again hit, you know, 20-plus home runs with an average close to 280.
One thing about that, though, is that – and I only found this in doing research on the AL piece – is that even though the home runs went up, because he was shortening his swing and because he wasn't trying for power, the batted ball distance on his fly balls actually dropped on average for the season about 10 feet. Now, you know, I'm kind of cautious with that because season to season those numbers are kind of random. But the power could have been one of those fluky things. And I'm not taking anything away from Moustakas as a player. I think the improvements are legitimate. But unlike Seager, to your question, Brett, I could see Moustakas, you know, dropping because of that to, say, 15 to 17 home runs. Or that's maybe a slightly more likely outcome than, say, jumping to 25 or jumping into that Seager class. You know, and to your point earlier, George, you know, Seager's a guy I look at where, you know, if he improves and gets to, say, 25 to 30, I wouldn't blink. You know, if Moustakas this year jumps to 25 to 30, I'd really be surprised.
Yeah, but I think it's worth pointing out how much he improved last year.
Oh, no doubt.
Especially against left-handers. I mean, he couldn't hit lefties at all. And last year he hit 280 against lefties. So there are some legitimate gains that he made last year that I think he's going to come close at least to repeating going forward. So he's definitely a top, you know, 10 to 12 guy now, as opposed to someone who may have been irrelevant in shallower formats.
I was addressing more Brett's question. Like, I think the improvements are legitimate. I just think the odds of Moose jumping up into the four tier or the four star tier are probably 50-50 at best.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. We also have to remember it's been a while, but, you know, Moustakas was a huge power hitting prospect. When he was
a bigger prospect than Paul Goldschmidt at one point, you know, and that's not completely fair because Goldschmidt kind of came out of nowhere. But yeah, he was a big time prospect.
He was as big of a prospect as Eric Hosmer. Moustakas hit 36 home runs in his last full minor league season back in 2010. He hit 322 with 36 home runs. He was going to be that next big thing. And then he pretty much had 2000 at bats of just nothing at the majors, at least compared to what people thought. And his line in the second half, I think, is just about what people were expecting back in 2011 and 2012, which is really fascinating at this point. So is he finally turning into that player? Has he improved his contact skills enough that he feels more comfortable hitting for more power? I don't know. I mean, the fly ball distance stuff is interesting, but you get, you know, you get weird things that factor in when you're changing your approach
there's some noise in those numbers. I just thought I'd point it out.
Well, yeah, and it is really interesting. It's you know, it's one of those things that defies logic when you look at it. But you know, there is a non-zero possibility that Moustakas can be a 30 home run hitter this year.
Oh yeah, no, and I mean he's 27 years old, and he's at that age where, you know, guy, and I mentioned Seager, you know, guys in their late 20s, early 30s sometimes hit that, you know, power peak, you know, even like in their peak or slightly post peak, where, you know, suddenly they start doing that.
Brett, who do you think is the better value, Kyle Seager in the 5th round or Mike Moustakas in the 10th, based on current ADPs?
I think it's Moustakas in the 10th, and I like Seager. I think there was enough there for Moustakas that I feel comfortable with him as a top 10 guy at the position.
I like him a lot more than Matt Duffy.
But dude, yeah, me too.
We can all agree on that.
Yeah, I do too. Duffy's one of the, of course, it's an even year, so I'm sure Matt Duffy's going to go out and hit 20 home runs and make us all look stupid.
Probably. So let's go to the two-star tier. We have a whole bunch of names in here that are interesting to talk about. So let's just kind of go around and pick one. Mike, who do you want to talk about in the two-star tier?
You know, it's you're putting me on the spot here. Let's talk a little bit about Pablo Sandoval.
Oh God.
he had, when you even combine his defense, you know, it was funny because I saw our colleague Ben Carsley arguing with somebody on Twitter, you know, just, you know, one of his followers who said, I think it was that Devers could play better defense in the majors, you know, and Ben's like, come on, you know, we're talking about minor league defense, you know, and low minors versus the majors. But all that being said, Sandoval did have an awful year all the way around on both sides of the ball. I think he's going to bounce back. But the thing about Sandoval is, even if he does bounce back, you know, he's just one of those guys, except for that one year he had for the Giants, you know, he's always just been kind of solid. He's never been like a big time power hitter. He's never really been a big time, you know, player and everything. He's just a guy who hits like 15 to 20 home runs. The average is okay. He doesn't really run. I think he's fine in this tier, and I buy the bounce back. And I don't want to completely ignore him, but I could see why after last year, you know, people are skittish and would take a lot of other hitters of this tier over him. And quite honestly, if you're in a mixed league and you want to bump Sandoval down to the one star where you say, no thanks, I just don't want to touch him, I can understand that as well.
Yeah, I wrote about Sandoval as my player to target on Monday, and you know, part of that is because, you know, he has been such a consistent option, and there's really nothing that's changed about him.
Well, and if he bounces back to what he did in 2014 and 2013, he's probably, with the possible exception of Justin Turner, he's probably the best hitter in this tier.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think that's absolutely fair. But, you know, everyone talked in his last 3 years in San Francisco, like, he's, you know, he's really good, but what would happen if he got out of San Francisco, you know, it's a huge pitcher's park, and he went to Fenway and everyone's expectations got raised. And I think he was like a fifth or a sixth rounder, if I remember correctly, last year, something like that.
Eighth rounder.
We're talking about last year, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's 15 team leagues, I think. So.
Yeah. And, you know, he was terrible in a hitter's park. But, you know, if it was just a terrible year, then it's just a terrible year. But.
You know, Brett, there is something, you know, we talk about this with Frazier, you talk about this all the time. There is something about that NL to AL transition that you always mention that's legit. And, you know, we should study this and write something about this one day. There is usually, unless it's a very old player or a guy at the end like Pat Burrell when he went to the Rays, there usually is the bounce back the second year in the AL. And there usually is something a lot closer to what the player's done before. So I think there's something to that. I think there's something to the idea that Sandoval, you know, had a lot of trouble adjusting to, you know, new pitching, new environment, and, you know, he should be able, you know, as the athlete and as a hitter he is, to bounce back.
Yeah, I agree. He is a much better athlete than people give him credit for. But, George, who do you want to talk about in this tier?
I want to talk about Danny Valencia, but I think the most interesting name in this tier is David Wright. How close do you guys think he was to being in the three-star tier? And what are your sort of general expectations with him? Because the health is obvious, but what do you see from him going forward as our two Mets experts?
I think that he'll be, I think he'll be better than expected when he plays, but I just have no confidence that he's going to play. You could tell that he started to turn things around towards the end of the playoffs last year. He was just brutal at the beginning of the postseason, and he started taking better at bats. He started driving the ball a little bit more, and, you know, that's something he's going to have to build off. But I mean, spinal stenosis is no joke. If you told me he was going to play in even 120 games this year, I'd say absolutely he's a three-star guy.
Yeah,
but the over/under on him for me is probably
100.
He played 38 last year in the regular season.
Yeah,
although, you know, a lot of that was because he missed most of the season and he came back. And he actually, when he came back, he played more. You know, he took some days off and they built him in, but he played more than I would have expected. But the Mets kind of built their team, you know, the way they built it last year. They built it so that a lot of guys can get breaks. And, you know, it almost reminds me of an NBA team in that they're building a team that, you know, they're going to probably not tank some games the regular season, but probably put their B lineup in here and again so that they can rest their regulars. And Wright's a big guy behind that. I think Wilmer Flores is going to play some third base. I think Ruben Tejada might play some third base. And, you know, I would expect Wright to play, you know, to your point, Brett, best game 120, best case 120. But I think 100 to 110, if he's healthy, is the more likely scenario. They're not going to run him out there every day. But, you know, he was really good when he played. His TAV was actually really high. That didn't manifest in a lot of power. But as an all-around hitter, he was solid. But, yeah, I think the issue is health. I think that he's really, you know, if you're buying him expecting him to play 140, 150 games, you're dreaming. It's more likely, I'm thinking 100 to 110, and I think the Mets really regulate how much he's on the field.
Yep. I figured it would be worth talking about him because everybody seems to have questions about David Wright. My guy's Danny Valencia, and Mike, we kind of talked about this on our email thread when we were debating the rankings for the tiers on this position, but Valencia last year, I mean, just look at the raw numbers. He hit 290 with 18 home runs and 378 plate appearances, and one of the catalysts for that was his sort of newfound success against right-handed pitching. At 31, he's been just disastrous against them. In his career, his career line against right-hand pitching was 237, 275, 389 against righties. Last year, between Toronto and Oakland, he hit 285 with a 556 slugging percentage and 13 home runs and 229 plate appearances. It's not a huge sample, but the fact that he was able to do that, I think, speaks volumes about the progress he's made. And ironically enough, he's going to pretty much the perfect home for him in Oakland, where even if he sucks against right-handers to start the year, I mean, they don't really have anyone else who can play third base there right now. They don't have a whole lot of options because they seem to be missing some person named Josh Donaldson, who they traded. That's besides the point. Valencia, I mean, even if he's terrible against righties, he kills left-handers, and Oakland's been so successful at platooning guys in the past, the last few years. I don't think they're going to hang him out to dry if he's bad against right-handers. So I think in a deeper format, I think he's a real interesting guy, especially if you have daily lineup changes. Brett, I know that's something you've talked a lot about in the past, but being able to platoon spots on your roster can sometimes be a huge advantage. And Valencia is a guy who fits that type of strategy perfectly if that's the route you want to go.
Yeah, it definitely does. That's a good point.
I just to counter this and kind of, you know, enlighten our listeners on the discussion. I the problem I had with Valencia, you know, in some of the things George said, you know, he jumped from, I think it was like a 663 OPS over his career against right-handers to about an 871. So even if there were some improvements made from a coaching standpoint, there's a lot of sample size, you know, small sample size going on in there, and it was really half a season. I do agree they won't hang him out to dry, but, you know, and some of this discussion, George, just ties more around, you know, league format. I do agree in a league format where I would say a 12-team league where you have liberal bench spots in mixed and you can roll Valencia out there on a day or on a week where they're facing a lot of lefties, I think he's a great play. In a deeper league, though, where you have to, you know, play him every week and there aren't a lot of other options, that's just where I'm wary of Valencia. I'm kind of wary of him in this tier. Because if he does slip and he does wind up hitting, say, 230 over the course of a full season because he's facing righties every day and he gets worn out by the grind, yeah, he could easily earn, say, 10 to 12. And I think that's okay. But I think in this tier, that kind of puts him at the bottom of the tier in a best case as opposed to the top.
Yeah, I think if he's a fit for your format and your team strategy, he's a very valuable, cheap piece to own. Otherwise, he's not really worth a whole lot, like you said.
The other thing I'd add to this, you know, you said he's what, 31 years old?
Yeah.
For every Raul Ibanez who has the late career resurgence and, you know, suddenly comes out of nowhere, and, you know, Ibanez put together almost a decade, you know, after he emerged, you know, as being a really good, really solid player, there are a lot of guys who just do it for half a season, maybe a full season, and wash out. And that's kind of what I'm nervous about. I'm nervous about the other end of that. If it's a total fluke and he washes out completely, you just get nothing. Again, it's format dependent. I think in some leagues it doesn't matter. If you're in an AL only and you bid, you know, I think Valencia earned, what I said, 17 or 18 last year. If you bid close to that in AL only and he washes out, that's a really big price to pay.
Yeah, right now his ADP, he's going in the 17th round. If he's able to sustain those gains against right-hand pitching and play every day and hit like he did last year, he's going to justify that price.
He could. If he hits like he did last year, that's going to be great. I guess I just see a lot of the downside with him. You know, and in terms of a mixed league and risks that I like to take, I'd prefer to take a risk on a younger guy than somebody on the age curve where Valencia is.
Yep.
Yeah. As sort of a follow-up to the question that I asked when we were on the four-star tier, if I told you there was a player in this tier who hit 208, 228, 325 with 55 strikeouts and 4 walks in the second half, would you be interested in that?
Of course not.
Is that Hector Oliveira?
Or? It was not Hector Oliveira.
Oliveira was actually pretty good.
Yeah. Any other guesses?
Jeez. Yasmani Tomas?
That is it. Yasmani Tomas.
Not very good.
799 OPS in the first half and then just completely cratered in the second half.
I had him in town. I remember it at one point in an NL only, I had him on the bench. So,
yeah. Oh. Yeah. And that's an OBP also. With
that that's OBP where he was better.
OBP.
But yeah. I mean, it just. Well, you know, the thing about Tomas, and we kind of talk about this, it's not to make an excuse. He'll never be as good as I think some people were, you know, thinking he'd be. But there is that idea of the rust and the wear and tear of you know, coming from Cuba and being in that whole situation. Jose Abreu is the marvelous exception to the rule. Some of these guys struggle year one. I don't think he'll ever be as good as I said, as anyone was expecting. But I think he can be a major league player and enough of a player with his third base eligibility, which will go away after this year, to warrant being in this tier.
Yeah, I actually am not nearly as down on Tomas as it seems by spitting out his second half stats. I think there is better hitting ability in there. I mean, the concern with Tomas when he came over was his strikeout rate in Cuba. And you know, he struck out 110 times in 426 plate appearances, which is not good, but it's not, you know, it's not something that you can't recover from, especially if you can actually show some modicum of power or patience, which he showed neither of. But he's also he did not come over as a finished product. He played last year at 24. He just turned 25 this offseason. So he's not a developed hitter. We see. I mean, Jose Abreu was a developed hitter when he came over. Yoenis Cespedes was a developed hitter.
You know, it's also worth pointing out the playing time got erratic for him starting in mid-August, and for a young hitter,
it was erratic all year.
It was, but you know, he went from, you know, if you go month by month, you know, he went from 98 at bats or 101 plate appearances in May to 97 in June, you know, down to 67 in August and 47 at the end of the year. And he was never optioned. So you have a young hitter kind of in and out of games, you know, sitting on the bench, not getting the reps. You know, again, not to make excuses, he didn't perform. But, you know, for a veteran who's used to that, it's a little bit easier to bounce back than for a young guy, as you point out, Brett, who's never done that. I you know, chances are good I will not own Tomas anywhere this year because I had him last year and I don't want to go through it again. But you know, on the other hand, if he's sitting there at the appropriate price in an NL only or a deep mix, I'm not going to, you know, completely shy away from him either.
Yep, I agree. I am not afraid of Yasmani Tomas in 2016, although this is the appropriate place for him. So let's move down to everyone's favorite game here. And does anyone remember who went first last week?
I think I did.
It was George. Right.
So, Mike, you're up first. Talk to us about the player who I'm fairly confident you're going to talk to us about.
You never get to go last, do you?
I get to go last all the time.
Well, that's right. I mean, you never get to go first.
I know.
I'm actually not really sure who – well, I will say that JP made this hard by leaving Derek Dietrich in here, who I advise shouldn't be here at all. I don't really see where the path is for him with the playing time. This is a do I have to pick one of these guys? Let's see if you're right or not. I'm going to go with Martin Prado. Was that your guess?
I was not right. No. Continue.
Well, this is kind of a weak list, and two of these guys, I don't even think they necessarily belong here, and I hate most of them. But Prado's somebody who has just kind of been solid year in, year out. The speed has disappeared. But for the one start here, if you compare his stats to, I'd say, half of the guys in the two start tier, it's not really hard to see him putting up numbers that are similar to some of those guys, maybe absent a few stolen bases. And if he has any bounce back at all in his batting average, from an earnings standpoint, he could easily be in the middle of that two-star tier. I can't say that for anyone else here, with the possible exception of Chase Headley, who, as much as I want to endorse Headley and say he's going to bounce back, he hasn't done anything significant in 3 years now, and that includes a year and a half in Yankee Stadium. So I've got to go with Prado. You know, it's the usual one-star. If I have to twist my arm, Prado's my guy here.
George, what about you?
I'm going to go with, reluctantly, we've talked about Derek Dietrich a lot. I'd pick him, but he doesn't really fit this tier that much. I'm going to go with Yunel Escobar, just because he had the craziest season of all time last year in terms of BABIP. He had a 347 BABIP. His career rate was like 306, and he hadn't been above 280 in 5 years. So I have no explanation for what happened last year, but he hit 314, and that's a big reason why. 9 home runs. I just think the playing time is going to be there. He's on the Angels now. Last year he was on the Nationals. I just think people are going to completely not care at all about him. I mean, look at the ADP. Where is he going right now? He's going in the 25th round of 15 team leagues right now in NFBC leagues. So he costs nothing, and I think he could hit reasonably 260 with close to 10 home runs. And if that's your last pick, I mean, you guys kind of talked a little bit about it when you recapped your Tout and Labor teams, that just having someone who's consistently getting at bats and doing something is valuable. And I think in a league format like that, where it's deeper than 12 teams, Escobar is not a bad guy to just have. That's all. I don't know what else to say. He's not very good, but he's something.
Yeah, this whole tier really
it's bad.
Really sucks, and it is why you want to make sure you are not ending up drafting one of these players, really.
There's probably some guys like not appearing in this tier that I might take, like one or two that I might take over the guys who are actually appearing here.
I don't know. I look through that. The guy who I am going to take is David Freese, and you know it's he's still older than I think. He's going to be 33 in April, but he hit 14 homers and hit 257 last year, and it's not that is so great, but he's going well behind some of the other names in this tier, which is just really sad. He's going 120 picks behind Yunal Escobar. He's going 160 picks behind Chase Headley, and I really think there's just about zero difference between them. You know, Freese is sort of the anti Yasmani Tomas. He in the second half, and Freese is a second half guy, has been a bit throughout his career. He hit 289, 358, 471 in the second half. It was only 36 games because he got hurt because he's David Freese. But you know, at this point, whatever. Give me David Freese. I'll take that. I'll take that shot.
Do either of you guys like Richie Schaefer at all? Prospect, no.
I like him as somebody who, in an AL only, who could come up and produce stats. But beyond that, no.
For those of you listening and wondering why haven't we talked about Joey Gallo, it's because he's in the outfield portion of our rankings. So don't freak out and think we ignored him. He's in the outfield.
That's a good point. Although I do mention him Friday in my. I mentioned him today in state of position, and I mentioned him Friday in the AL only piece.
Yep,
sounds good. So with that, let's take a break and come right back. We are back. So that is it for episode 76 of Flags Fly Forever. We will be back next week with shortstops because we don't believe in going counterclockwise. Read us at baseballprospectus.com. Follow us on Twitter. Ask us questions. Do all of those things. That is all. Hope you have a better rest of the week than Donald Trump. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
I'm just going to try and come up with a Bernie Sanders joke, and I can't.
I'm not even paying attention to the caucuses, so I have no idea what's going on.
Me neither. I just assume he's losing.